Hello there, and welcome to Short Science, your 80s-themed portal for all the very best science in brief. I'm Elizabeth Hawke.
And I'm Emma Berger. Coming up on today's show, the latest science and health stories in News in Brief. I'll be looking at scientific women Marianne Pierret-Porser, Cecilia Payne-Gaposchkin and Jane Goodall in Capsule Science. And in Capsule Medicine, Elizabeth will be considering the contributions of Marie Curie, Elizabeth Blackwell and Elizabeth Garrett Anderson to medicine.
And in our guest slot this week, we'll be hearing about the 100 Women, 100 Visions exhibition celebrating women working in science.
All that will be coming up on today's show, along with our brand new quiz and some more science trivia for you to fathom out at home.
This is Short Science.
So, this week, it's all about us girls. Well, women in science.
That's right. Now, we're considering the contribution of some big-name women to the field of science and medicine in honour of the upcoming Women in Science Day on the 28th of February and International Women's Day on the 8th of March. And we'll be hearing about a City Hall exhibition entitled 100 Women, 100 Visions, celebrating women in science that originated here at Imperial College.
Now, frequent listeners will know all about our fantastic website. The address is www.shortscience.co.uk. If you've never checked it out, it is worth a look, if only for the fabulous 80s stylings.
But stylings aside, there's also a lot of useful information to be found there. Now, you can find out what's coming up on the show, listen again to a show you might have missed or really liked, and you can subscribe to the podcast or listen to it online via our handy podcast page.
Plus, you can send in your profile for everyone to take a look at and even have your very own Capsule Science to tell people about your science.
Now, we're really interested in what you think about science, or indeed about short science, so send us an email to studio@shortscience.co.uk for a mention on the show, or if there's some burning question that you'd like us to answer, drop us a line. Now, you can also request a Capsule Science or medicine topic or volunteer to be a guest on the show.
So before we get going with this show, it is time to flag up our science event for this week.
Yeah, so seeing as we're going to be hearing all about the 100 Women's 100 Visions exhibition a little bit later on, I thought we'd better give you the details.
So what's that all about?
Well, this is a photographic portrait exhibition celebrating the success of women in science. Now, I won't say too much about the details, as we are going to hear more later on, but the exhibition is at City Hall until the 19th of March. Now, it's completely free to get in, and anyone can just go along to City Hall and take a look during City Hall opening hours. And there's also an online exhibition of the same photographs at www.imperialcollegeunion.org/100women100visions, and those 100s in there are numbers.
So more details will be available on our website events page at www.shortscience.co.uk/science events, also all one word, including a link to that online exhibition.
Now it's time for this week's science news in brief.
Pluto's changing colour.
Sperm put on the moves to impress the egg.
Winds carry migrating insects.
Smoking, passive smoking, and now third-hand smoking.
So, starting us off this week, images from the Hubble telescope have come back, showing us our clearest ever pictures of the dwarf planet Pluto.
Ooh, and have they shown us anything interesting then?
Well, the pictures have shown us that the surface of Pluto is changing quite dramatically. The pictures were taken in 2002 and 2003, but have taken years to come back to us. Now, they show that in those few years at the beginning of the noughties, the surface colour of Pluto became 20 to 30% redder after remaining fairly constant for the 50 years previously.
Okay, so do we know why it's got redder?
Well, methane frost on the surface of the planet breaks down into a reddish substance when it's exposed to UV light from the sun. Now, the pictures have also shown that the northern hemisphere has brightened while the southern hemisphere has darkened, which seems to do with the ice melting in the north and refreezing in the south. Therefore, all these changes seem to be to do with the weather on Pluto, which is changing due to its changing position with respect to the sun.
A bit like the seasons on Earth, then?
Yeah, except more exaggerated, I guess.
OK, well, the first health story today is the news that a molecular switch has been identified in the sperm that allows it to transform from a regular swim-along sperm to a super-gonna-get-there-first sperm.
Don't sperm set off swimming like mad at first anyway, then?
Well, no, they're relatively inactive in the male, waiting for the green light, as it were, and then when they enter the female reproductive tract, they start swimming. But interestingly, they swim faster the closer they get to the egg.
OK, so what's this switch then?
Well, scientists were studying the flow of protons in the sperm's tail, and they found that there are many proton channels called HV1 channels in the tail, and that They are therefore affected by changes in pH and zinc concentration in the sperm's environment. Now, zinc levels are higher in the male reproductive tract, and that helps to keep the sperm in a ready-for-action state. And then the pH increases as you get nearer to the fallopian tubes inside the female, and this encourages the sperm to swim faster.
Okay, so is this going to have any implications for male infertility then?
Well, yes. If men are deficient in zinc, then the sperm aren't held in that ready-for-action state, and by the time they reach the female reproductive tract, they've already burnt out from swimming too fast for no good reason. And they don't have any energy left for the long swim ahead. Now, another chemical called anandamide has the same effect as zinc, and this is affected by cannabis smoking, again, reducing fertility.
So men need to steer clear of the cannabis and make sure they have plenty of zinc in their diet to remain at the ready, I guess. So next this week, insects can migrate much faster than their flying speed by using wind streams, which carry them for large distances.
Okay, so what kind of insects are we talking about here?
Well, in this case, the use of wind to speed up a migratory journey has been observed in moths and butterflies.
So why and how do moths and butterflies migrate, considering they have such very short lifespans?
Well, the journey of migration can actually take place over many generations as they journey gradually towards the warmer Mediterranean climate for the winter and back towards the north in summer. So this means a choice for the good of the species, as each successive generation can be born in a mild climate. I mean, if an individual didn't migrate, as it wasn't too cold then, the next generation would be born into the cold and it wouldn't survive.
Okay, if they want to travel at high speeds, they need quite strong winds, but how do they avoid becoming damaged or going the wrong way if the wind's blowing the wrong way?
Well, it's thought that the insects detect the fastest wind streams going the right way, using some sort of detection of a turbulence effect. And once inside the wind stream, the moth or butterfly is simply swept along, so it doesn't feel the actual strength of the wind.
Well, fascinating stuff there. Well, finally today, we all know about the dangers of smoking, and indeed the dangers of passive smoking, where we are directly exposed to the smoke from someone else's cigarette. But now scientists are warning about the carcinogenic potential of third-hand smoke.
So what exactly is third-hand smoke?
Well, this is when nicotine particles have been deposited on surfaces like walls, curtains or furniture. Now, these particles can then interact with chemicals in the air to become carcinogenic.
So we can just pick up cancer from touching these surfaces?
Well, Stephen Hecht at the Masonic Cancer Centre at the University of Minnesota thinks that this could be an overreaction. But technically, you could absorb these carcinogens through the skin, and there is a potential risk there that needs further evaluation.
Oh, so more bad news about smoking there.
Indeed. But any comments or questions about any of our news today, you know what to do. Send us an email to studio@shortscience.co.uk. Now it's time for Capsule Science. So, as we've mentioned maybe just once or twice so far this morning, this week is all about women in science. So we'll be profiling some women who have made important contributions to their respective science subjects. So Emma, who are you going to start off with?
Well, starting with the furthest back in time of my women, I've chosen Marie-Anne Pierrette Pulsar. Now, one of the reasons I've chosen her is that she is also known as Madame Lavoisier, wife of the Frenchman known as the father of modern chemistry, Antoine Lavoisier.
So you've chosen her because she's the wife of a famous male scientist?
Well, yes, in a way, but I have chosen her for her achievements in her own right. The reason I think it's important to flag up that she was married to a famous male scientist is that she lived from 1758 to 1836, and at that time it was nearly impossible for a woman to get into the world of science on her own merit.
As it was nearly impossible for a woman to do almost anything on her own merit at that time.
Exactly. Now, many women involved in science at that time got the opportunity because scientific pursuits were mostly carried out in home-based science labs. So the wives of male scientists could then find themselves becoming lab assistants and taking an active role in scientific research. And in fact, as men did have the balance of power, we don't really know how many scientific breakthroughs came from the male scientists who officially published the work and how many came from their intelligent wives.
So what did one or other or both of the Lavoisiers achieve then?
Well, in the 18th century, chemists were working with the idea of phlogiston, an element they added to the theory of four elements: earth, air, water and fire. Now, they thought that phlogiston accounted for the combustion of certain substances. However, Lavoisier found out about these theories because his wife, a skilled linguist, translated foreign scientific works for him. Now, as she was translating an essay on phlogiston, she also added her own notes and criticisms, which prompted Antoine Lavoisier to question the theory of phlogiston.
So what did they do then?
Well, they embarked on a series of experiments on combustion, which led to the eventual discovery of the element oxygen.
Well, I suppose that does sound like quite an important contribution to chemistry.
Indeed.
Well, who's up next then?
Cecilia Payne Gaposchkin. Now, born in 1900 in Buckinghamshire, she went to school in London before winning a scholarship to Cambridge University in 1919. She was allowed to study botany, physics and chemistry, but at that time, women were not awarded actual degrees from the university, so she was at a disadvantage. However, an interest in astronomy was ignited there, and she went on to gain a place on a graduate programme in astronomy at the Harvard College Observatory in the States.
Well, how did she manage to do that then?
Well, a fellowship had just been started up there to encourage women to study, a beginning of a more enlightened time, I guess. So Cecilia Payne was only the second woman to get that fellowship.
Well, that's her life story, but presumably she made an important contribution to science.
Well, indeed. At that time, it was thought that the Sun had a similar composition to the Earth. However, in 1925, she showed that helium, and especially hydrogen, were much more abundant in the Sun than on Earth. Now, at that time, Henry Norris Russell, a colleague of hers, dismissed these conclusions. But in 1929, further evidence prompted Russell to publish a paper concluding that hydrogen was present in the quantities Payne had originally suggested.
Well, that doesn't sound too good for her, but we've got time for one more scientific woman.
So finally, a very modern type of scientist, mostly because she's been on television, Jane Goodall. She was born in 1938 and she is still working. And she's extremely well known for her films on chimpanzees, but has done a huge amount of work and research on primates, especially the chimpanzees. Now, a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about research with animals, and her work is a prime example of sociological and behavioural studies on chimpanzees.
So what she discovered through all this work then?
Well, one of her major discoveries was that chimpanzees can make tools, something that had previously only been attributed to humans. She's also the only human that has ever been accepted into a troop of chimpanzees.
Well, what's she up to now then?
She is involved in all kinds of projects protecting chimpanzees and other conservation work.
Well, thanks very much, Emma. That was some fascinating stuff there. Now, if you have any questions about anything Emma has been telling us, or if you would like to suggest a capsule science topic for another week, then please get your laptop open, your typing fingers poised, and send an email to studio@shortscience.co.uk. Now it's time to meet this week's guests. Now, I was lucky enough to meet up with the organisers and participants of the 100 Women, 100 Visions project to find out more.
The project that we call 100 Women, 100 Visions is a series of 100 photographs of female staff and students here at Imperial College. And they were taken by a professional photographer called Jackie King. And when I say we, that's the WSET, which is a student society called Women in Science, Engineering and Technology.
Ellen Saunders, a PhD student in the Department of Electrical and Electronic Engineering here at Imperial College.
The second exhibition of this series, which is going to happen at City Hall from the 15th of February until the 19th of March, is beyond the academic community. So whereas the first time around, the photos were on show here in the main entrance, now we want to try and reach a wider audience, and City Hall is such a great venue because it's open to the public. So not only do you get the widespread of the general public, tourists, but also school students and just anybody who walks along the river and wants to have a look. You also get representatives from the public and the private sectors, from all walks of life and politicians. And I hope that all of these people will be inspired and maybe come away with a different idea of who a scientist actually is.
So it's a fantastic location, being open to the general public and, as you say, politicians, statesmen, anybody could just go in there and you don't know what kind of influence they might have. How important do you think it is that you've used an artistic approach to spread your message?
I think pictures show so many different things. It's the good old saying, a picture says 1,000 words. First of all, as you say, creativity has been such a central thing. It injects a sense of fun. There is not this serious, if you like, typical scientific ordered approach. There is a much more inviting sense of these pictures that get anybody to walk up to them and have a look and read the captions underneath, which says a little bit about the woman. So I think the creative approach draws people in, and then we can use that to send really our two main messages, which are that there are so many women now who study and work in science and engineering, and we want to really celebrate that fact through these positive and happy images. And also, of course, the pictures don't show what people would perhaps normally perceive as the typical scientist, because there is no such thing as a typical scientist. So when you put these 100 images together, they form a really powerful message together.
Do you think there's a slight danger, because the exhibition focuses just on women, and obviously all the pictures are of women in science, that it makes women somehow seem special or in need of special attention?
That's definitely an interesting question. I mean, I suppose in a way women are in need of special attention, particularly when you look up the academic ladder, where women are still underrepresented. So there is still work to be done, which is one of the reasons why this exhibition is important. But it is also, I think, that those who see the picture see that they send a positive message. So it's a message of saying, it's so great that we've come this far. It's important for science that we've come this far, because all these brilliant people, you know, who weren't contributing to the science and engineering sectors 100 years ago, now there are so many of us here, and that's great. So let's celebrate that.
Now, 100 women, in anybody's estimation, that's a lot of people to find and ask and to get cooperating in a manner to get all the pictures looking so fantastic. How did you go about getting the group of women together?
Basically, we wanted anybody who was interested and who had time to come down to join us in this project, and we were really overwhelmed by the number of people who were keen to do this. So that was really no problem in terms of getting the people. What was, of course, difficult was to fit 100 women's very busy schedules together in 15-minute time slots over a period of 4 days, shooting non-stop in a temporary photo studio here on campus. So that was an administrative challenge, but it was a lot of fun. I think everybody agreed the experience, while it was a bit hectic, had this creative buzz about it, which everyone really enjoyed.
Hi, I'm Sissy Wong. I'm a postdoctoral research associate. I work at the Respiratory Pharmacology Group at the NHLI under Professor Maria Balvisi's direction.
Tell us a bit about what it was like to be involved in this project.
It was great to be one of the 100 women that represent Imperial College. We went along to this workshop to find out more about what this project was about, the reasons why they were doing it, and it all seemed very interesting, and I was really happy to be one of the 100 women.
And tell us a bit about on the day when you had your photographs taken. There were presumably a lot of women milling about, all nervously waiting their turn to go in front of the camera. What was it like, and what sort of support do they give you, makeup and wardrobe advice, anything like that?
It was great. Everyone had their own props, their own ideas about how to pose in front of a camera, and they had like makeup artists there and people to show you how to stand in front of a camera. And Jackie, the photographer, she was excellent. She made the whole atmosphere very relaxed, and everybody seemed to really enjoy the actual shooting section.
Now, you were pregnant in your picture, and that obviously gives a very striking image of womanhood that is slightly different to all the other pictures. How did you find being pregnant in the image, and how important was it for you to be captured in that moment of your life?
Being pregnant at that time was definitely one exciting moment for myself. Now, with my daughter being 8 months old, I'm back to work, and I'm really enjoying both family life and my work life together.
That's a lovely document of you being successful as a woman, a scientist and a mother.
My advice to women studying in my discipline is just
network,
to do it.
And a mentor is very helpful if you want to pursue a
bioengineering is fun so and rewarding, as you can contribute to
work really suits my personal and career goals.
If you find a subject interesting and are considering taking it further, I'd say just go for it. With hard work, the sky's the limit. My advice to young women is to have a can-do attitude, work hard, and seek out inspiring scientists to be their mentor. Just a few of the inspiring captions partnering the portraits of the 100 Women, 100 Visions exhibition.
If I am not for myself, who will be for me? If I am not for others, what am I? If not now, when? That was written by Hillel the Elder, who lived in 110 BC, Babylon. My name is Leslie Cohen. I'm a professor of physics in solid state physics at Imperial College.
Professor Cohen, I wonder if I could start off by asking why you got involved in the 100 Women, 100 Visions project.
My role in college, I have many roles actually. I'm head of solid state physics. One of my other roles is as academic ambassador for and to women in the college for the Faculty of Natural Sciences. But supporting women and encouraging more women into science has been an area of interest for me for about 20 years. I ran a little grassroots organisation called AWISE, back in the mid-90s, and we produced a booklet called Voices from Women in Science, which was, in fact, the views of women who were postdocs from Imperial, also from Oxford and Cambridge. And that really started the efforts on supporting women at Imperial. So, with all that history, and also my role as academic ambassador for women, when I was approached to support this project, I thought it was excellent. The project was to capture women at all stages of their progress through the college and to celebrate their contribution as women, as scientists, as potential academics and industrialists in scientific areas. And I felt that it had great potential to publicise that celebration.
And how instrumental was your support in helping the girls get the project off the ground?
Well, all credit to realising the project goes to Ellen Saunders and Irene Spencer. Without them, there would be no project. It did require some weighty backing, both financial, and all the three academic ambassadors and the Academic Opportunity Committee and Human Resources all put in most of the money, although I do believe that the Student Fund also contributed. But it did require permission from the College Secretary, so it required a bit of an old lag, as it were, to help smooth things along. But really, they deserve all the credit.
Ellen Saunders, Sissy Wong and Professor Leslie Cohen of the 100 Women, 100 Visions project. Now it's time for Capsule Medicine.
So, thinking about the contributions of women to science, Elizabeth is going to consider some important women in the context of medicine.
That's right. Now, you might consider my first female to be a bit of a cheat. Not on her part, but on mine, as she wasn't a doctor or a medic at all. In fact, she was a physicist who made great contributions to the world of both physics and chemistry, even winning a Nobel Prize in each. And she was the first ever female professor to serve at the University of Paris.
And this Wonder Woman of science is...
Marie Curie. Now, she was born in Poland and eventually, with some help from her sister, came to Paris to study at the Sorbonne. Now, she always wanted to return home to Poland but couldn't work as a scientist there. So she eventually settled in Paris, having met her husband Pierre Curie, a physicist, the love of her life.
So, what was her main discovery or contribution to the world of medicine?
Well, a chap called Henri Becquerel had discovered that uranium salts emitted rays similar to X-rays, and using a gadget that Pierre and his brother had invented called an electrometer, Marie Curie was able to prove that these rays were coming directly from the uranium and not from an interaction between uranium and something else.
So she basically discovered radioactivity.
That's about the size of it, yeah. And this was an immensely important find for medicine, although it might not have been if Marie Curie herself had not made the leap between radioactivity and treating cancer.
So is the cancer angle her main contribution to medicine?
Well, it is the most wide-reaching, but on a more individual level, she pioneered the use of portable radiography units to treat wounded soldiers on the field during World War I. And she actually went out there and did this herself using radon that she had purified and provided.
So what about the treatment of cancer then?
Well, Marie Curie set up the Institut Curie. Now, this is a large facility in Paris that concentrates on biophysics, cell biology and oncology. Now, Marie Curie really placed radiation at the disposal of oncologists, flagging it as a useful tool in the treatment of cancer, allowing further research to develop this whole field of medicine.
Okay, so that's Marie Curie, but you also mentioned two Elizabeths, like yourself, of the medical world.
That's right, Elizabeth Blackwell and Elizabeth Anderson Garrett. Now, Elizabeth Blackwell was the first ever female physician. Now, I have to clarify, there were actually some physicians who were technically and genetically female, but disguised themselves as men, but she was the first openly female physician. Now, she was born in Bristol, England, but following several family tragedies, her family emigrated to New York when she was 11 years old. Now, Elizabeth's family were quite particular. They were very strict Quakers and totally anti-slavery, and they had to move around to find work that didn't involve slaves, and her father eventually opened a refinery in Ohio. Now, Elizabeth had been educated at home, and when her father died, she took up
teaching positions in Kentucky so that she could save up money to study medicine.
So was studying medicine easier in the States at that time?
Not really. She lived with the family of a doctor and began her medical learning from the books in his library. She then got into medical school by a total fluke. The Faculty of Medicine didn't want to admit her and said that they would put the matter to a student vote, thinking that all the students would say no. And the students assumed it was a hoax and voted her in.
But did she have the support of at least some of the students then?
Not at all. They were really horrible to her at every opportunity. But in 1849, she did manage to graduate, and she was first in her class.
So she graduated and then was able to work as a doctor?
No. She was not allowed to practice and ended up having to move to France, where she trained as a birthing practitioner. But she then caught a nasty eye infection from a baby and had to have her eye removed. So after that, she went back to New York, and there she set up a facility to train nurses before eventually returning to England.
So then did she get to practice as a doctor?
Well, due to a loophole in the law, her foreign medical degree outranked her status as a woman, and her name was submitted to the medical register, and she was allowed to practice medicine in England. And along with Florence Nightingale, she then opened the London School of Medicine for Women before retiring.
Okay, so where does Elizabeth Garrett Anderson fit into this then?
Well, Elizabeth Garrett Anderson was the first female doctor to train and practice in the UK. Now, she struggled to get training and completed many separate degrees in anatomy and medical sciences. However, the institutions wouldn't enter her for the qualifying exams. Eventually, the Society of Apothecaries allowed her to sit their licence exams, and this allowed her name to be entered onto the medical register, the second female entry after Elizabeth Blackwell. She then worked as a doctor in London, helping women to access treatment by female physicians.
Well, this is amazing to hear, but I am going to have to stop you there. Now, if you have any questions or comments about this week's Capsule Medicine, please chuck an email our way at studio@shortscience.co.uk, and we will do our best to answer your questions.
So now we are continuing with our 2010 quiz from last week. I'm going to go first. So my question number one for Emma. Which London hospital has an Elizabeth Garrett Anderson wing? Is this A, St George's Hospital, B, King's College Hospital, or C, University College Hospital?
Well, I don't know. Basically, I've been fortunate enough never to have been in any of them. Now it depends. Did she set it up? Was it named after her as a big medical person? University, they're all kind of university hospitals, aren't they?
I think it's a named after her rather than a setup.
Yeah, okay. So, okay, because I was thinking about the ages of the hospitals. It's going to have to be a random guess. So, I'm going to go for University College Hospital.
That's the right answer.
Oh, that's such a fluke.
Yeah, St George's. St George's Hospital has all the wings named after famous surgeons and things like that. It's got the Jenner wing, Hunter wing, etc. King's College, I'm not sure about the wings there. And University College does indeed have the Elizabeth Anderson Garrett wing.
That is amazing.
Go on then, what's your first question?
Right. So my first question is, who is the first woman named in records in the history of science? A, Margaret Cavendish, B, Merit Ptah, if that's how you pronounce it, or C, Hypatia of Alexandria?
Well, I'd like to think that Hypatia of Alexandria would be the first one, and like because of like all the libraries and Egyptians and Romans and stuff like that. Obviously, you can see my history is extensive and knowledgeable. But that sounds a bit obvious to me, like that's put in there particularly to trick me. Like, she probably did something but was never written down or something like that. Merit Ptah I've never heard of, and Margaret Cavendish just sounds too modern. I'm going to go with my first instinct, I think, and go for C, Hypatia of Alexandra.
Well, she was pretty near the beginning, but apparently, I mean, you know, this is assuming my source is correct, Merit Ptah, ancient Egyptian kind of physician woman.
After I said it, I suddenly thought, actually, Ptah sounds really Egyptian.
Yeah.
I don't know why. It looks a bit like Pharaoh if you kind of squint your eyes. So,
yeah, so ancient Egyptian woman. I mean, yeah, actually, I think women were kind of up there in ancient Egypt as well. They weren't quite so done down with. And yeah, Margaret Cavendish wasn't until the 17th century, so she was a long way away. And Hypatia of Alexandria was a medical or scientific woman in Alexandria, place of learning. But yeah, apparently it was B, Merit Ptah.
Okay, well, my second question for Emma. What was Marie Curie's maiden name? And she actually is usually known by Marie Curie slash and then her maiden name.
Yeah.
So is it, and is it going to get a chance to witness my Polish here, A, Sklodowska, B, Zarawski, or C, Dlusky?
Well, do you know what? I must have seen this 1,000 times because, you know, Marie Curie is very famous, and yet I'm really not sure. So
I thought you'd know this one straight off. This is
it's quite embarrassing that I don't know.
Have you ever written an essay about Marie Curie?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, that would be even more shocking if you'd actually written about it.
No, I've not, you know, ugh, damn school.
You obviously went to the wrong school.
Yeah.
You should write to them.
Yeah, definitely. No Marie Curie essays. Right, but okay, I'm just going to go for the one that sounds most familiar or just leaps out at me. So I'm going to go for Sklodowska.
Is the correct answer.
Okay, it must have been somewhere subliminally having seen it.
The other two names were names from her life, so boyfriends and the like.
There you go, Polish ones.
I think boyfriend and brother-in-law are the other two.
Okay.
Go on then, my second question.
Right, let's go. Which woman translated Newton's Principia Mathematica into French? I mean, this is the first one, and apparently is the one that's still mostly used, but there may be other translations. Is it A, Marie-Anne Lavoisier, B, Emily du Châtelet, or C, Adelaide Huber?
Well, now, you mentioned that Marie-Anne Lavoisier was doing some translating, so that could be, like, a clue, or it could be a red herring, and that you want me to go into that trap, and actually it's one of the other two. I mean, I'd assume that a lot of translation was done by women, so there must be lots of women, which means that all three of them could, in fact, be translators, and I would know, because...
Indeed.
I just don't know about things like that.
It's a murky maze.
It is. So I'm going to go with the obvious, although that hasn't done me very well so far, and say Marie-Anne Lavoisier.
Well, no, unfortunately, it was Emily du Châtelet, and apparently she also came up with the derivation of the conservation of energy principle. So, yes, and apparently it's still the translation used. So she translated Principia Mathematica, and yeah, Marie-Anne Lavoisier did translate a lot, but apparently not that. And Adelaide Huber I just made up.
Yeah, that was my first choice, if I wasn't going to go for the obvious. So I obviously would not have won on any circumstances.
Right, question three.
I'm on 0-2, you're on 2-2. It's very depressing. This is Emma's third question. From what radiation-associated condition did Marie Curie die? Was it A, leukemia, B, skin cancer, or C, aplastic anemia?
Right. Well, obviously, she worked a lot with radiation, so that makes sense. I'm going to cross off skin cancer because I don't think it was that, but maybe it was. And again, go for a bit of a guess, which has done me well today.
it's shocking, actually, you're guessing. I think there's some influence somewhere in there.
And I'm going to go with... I mean, obviously, I have read about the life of Marie Curie, so I guess it's kind of in there, and I just don't recall exactly the facts. So I'm just going to go for leukemia.
No, it wasn't. Yeah. It was aplastic anemia.
Yeah, that does actually make more sense. Yeah.
So Emma has scored 2 out of 3, and it's now my turn to try and get just one measly point with my final question.
Okay, here we go. Final question. Of the Nobel Prizes in physics, chemistry, and physiology or medicine, because those are the ones I'm counting as scientific, on how many occasions have prizes been awarded to women? A, 5, B, 16, or C, 22?
Okay, well... Marie Curie won 2, so that's 2.
Yep.
Her daughter Irene won 1, so that's 3. I'm sure one of the DNA or genetics types ones has been won by a woman, so that's 4, which doesn't help me when the answers are 5, 16 and 22. But I don't think it's going to be 16 or 22 because that's an awful lot, and I just can't think of that many big... discoveries even.
But it has been going since about 1900 or something.
Yeah.
And they started in 1903, was it, with Marie Curie? So that's quite a long time ago.
Yeah. No, I'm going to go with 5. I don't think there's that many.
Well, the correct answer is 16. Ugh. 16 occasions have prizes been awarded to women. That's occasions rather than women, because obviously Marie Curie won it twice. And yeah, I mean, in recent years, I guess more women have started winning them.
But can you name them? I really think that if that's the answer and you're going to take my point away, you should be able to name them.
Well, I do have a list.
In order.
In order.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I had a list.
And then alphabetically,
to
make sure.
I don't have it on me. I can't recall all 16 women, unfortunately. But, you know, maybe I should get one taken away then for not being able to remember all of them.
No, I think that would be a bit mean. Okay, well, I did horrifically badly there, scoring 0 out of 3, and Emma did a little bit better, well, actually quite a lot better, with 2 out of 3. So we'll pick up this battle again next week.
But I bet you're going to get your revenge. It was a lucky week for me as well. I didn't really know anything. I just guessed well.
Yeah, I didn't know anything and didn't get any points. So I don't think that's very fair, but never mind. Okay, but for now, it's time to announce the answer to last week's science trivia question, which was...
Right, what vehicle of warfare was first used in 1176, blimey, powered by a hand crank?
And the answer to that question was a submarine. So well done to everyone who emailed in with that answer.
Now, this week, the question for you to puzzle over is, what radioactive element can be extracted from carnotite and pitchblende?
Okay, so if you know the answer, please drop us an email to studio@shortscience.co.uk. That's about all we've got time for today, but before we sign off, if you've got any comments or questions, don't forget to email us at studio@shortscience.co.uk. You can send your suggestions for capsule medicine and science, and let us know if you'd like to be a guest on the show. You can also submit your profile if you'd like to be added to our website and have your very own capsule there for everyone to take a look at. So we really want to know what it's like for you to be working in science and what it is that's important or interesting about your science.
Yep, so the website is www.shortscience.co.uk. You can also listen again to the show from the Imperial College Radio website at www.icradio.com. And tomorrow the podcast will be out and available for download. You can subscribe to us via iTunes, just search for Short Science or follow the link from our website. Alternatively, you can subscribe with any number of podcatchers by following the subscribe link on our podcast page.
So, thank you very much for listening. This has been Short Science. Our guests today were Ellen Saunders, Professor Leslie Cohen, and Sissy Wong. The presenters were Emma Berger and myself, Elizabeth Hawke. The production was done by our own good selves, and the theme tune was written and produced by Don Gould of Music by Design.
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back at the same time next week for another episode of Short Science.